is support Palestinians in protest, and then also come back and share our experience and sort of, you know, bear witness to a certain extent, just about what is going on there.
Can I just continue?
Sure, please.
Okay. I want to say that there's something that I feel has to be straightened out here, and that's because either we know little history or we tend to have an amnesia about events of the past. And since I'm probably one of the oldest people sitting here today, I'd like to remind you of something. At the age of 13, I became a Zionist at a time when my entire family, that's a very large extended Jewish family, across New Jersey, good parts of New York, none of them were pro-Zionist. Not only were they not pro-Zionist, they didn't know what the hell it was all about. And they thought I was the crazy kid of many, many kids of my age in the family. And then it was the average to have about 4 or 5 children in a family. I found it very interesting that in 51, when I went to Israel, I really was the pariah. From that point of view, I was the crazy kid and the pariah, because I wanted to build a homeland for the Jewish people of the world. I had been imbued since the time I was 13, and at 21, I was literally the bride going off to Israel to do my thing. In 67, after many things that I have no time to go into, but after Hamayim Higiu Ad Nafesh, meaning we were already choking from all of the brutalities, of the atrocities, of the terrible things we could not reconcile, my husband and I, with living in Israel, I came back, and lo and behold, I regarded myself as a non-Zionist then. Now I would call myself an anti-Zionist, but my whole family, out of nowhere, had become Zionists. And I asked myself, what happened in the process? Well, I know very well what happened in the process, because I lived in Israel, I lived in a kibbutz, and I lived, and I was a teacher in the kibbutz, little children, and I had to fight with the fathers who would tell their children terrible, nightmarish stories before they went to sleep about the various ways in which they tortured Arabs during the war, quote unquote, the war of independence. And I must tell you in a nutshell that over the years that I was there, it was quite a long time. I was a kindergarten teacher. I then was an elementary school teacher. And I noted the changes in the books, in the pictures of the books, in the references. It wasn't, Hanukkah was not about the Syrians. Hanukkah was about the Fada'in and the Arabs who surrounded us and so forth. So little by little, this new notion of the other, namely the Palestinians, that was a dirty word, nobody ever uttered it, as you said. The Arabs were our enemies, they were ready to stick a knife in our backs, and we lived with this kind of thing. But when the people came from the United States or Canada or Europe to visit Israel, they only showed them the show places. They never showed them how the immigrants lived in the Ma'barot, in the transit huts, the places where they never could come out of their holes. They never took them to the Palestinian villages. It was really a kind of, Michael Jackson, what does he call his Never Neverland?
Neverland.
It was a Never Neverland. That's what it was. Because nobody ever saw what was happening on the other side. Now, to get to the main point, I must tell you that I began as a religious Jew on my own. My family were not religious. They had been, but they weren't. They wanted to be Americans. They didn't want me to speak Yiddish. They didn't want me to speak Hebrew. Okay? So I began as religious, a good religious Jew. I then moved on to become a Fabrenta, as we say in Yiddish, a burning fanatic Zionist. Okay? And went through that whole period. And then I said, I'm not sure. Am I Jewish? Because everybody around me seems to think so differently than I did. So I wasn't sure whether I was Jewish. I wasn't sure whether I was a humanist. I sat here tonight and I listened to you people. I must tell you that both Helga and Shira were music to my ears. in the sense that they didn't come from, they came into a, they experienced the kind of transformation. They went with, you know, certain ideas, perhaps you less, Helga, than Shira. But something happened. And I wanted this to happen tonight. I don't know where you people come from. I don't know whether you're Jewish or not Jewish. It's not important. But their eyes opened up. This whole myth that I had to live with for so many years, think about it, from 13 till about 40, that's a long time of my life, living, recognizing that there's so much of a myth about Israel. And here tonight, for the first time, I feel very comfortable. Why? Because I came to Canada deciding, as you did, I don't want to hear any more after Israel about Israel. I was so fed up with what happened in 1967, the occupation. I said, I want to turn my back on that. Then I came to teach at McGill, and I taught Hebrew, okay, for 7 years, until I was fired because of the fact that, never really, the word was not fired, I was replaced because the program could be better served by someone else. That meant a person who was either religious or a Zionist. And by that time, I was neither. And little by little, between my family, who didn't want to speak to me, they spoke to me about everything, but don't touch Israel, okay? And the same thing with many friends in the community. I went to synagogues, I confronted things that were happening in the community, and I really felt, you remember when we went to that synagogue together? And we, there was a, also a, an issue about Palestinians at being suspended from Concordia in the 80s, and they were ready to lynch us, okay? Now, I then got the feeling, you know, is it the end? Is it the end? Will nothing ever change? Will I ever be able to go into a Jewish institution and feel it's mine? After all, I've given so much of my life to being Jewish, to the state of Israel that I then believed in. And tonight I sat here and listened to you wonderful people, and I said to myself, yes, first and foremost, I'm a humanist. Secondly, I'm Jewish because of background. Jews do not have a monopoly on humanism. There are many great humanists, very, very great Jewish humanists, but we don't have a monopoly on it, and we have no right to be selective about it, including Erwin Cutler, and I wish he were here today, the Minister of Justice.
Exactly.
So
right.
my final statement to you is thank you, because what you have done for me is very, very important. Finally, I sit in a room, people talking openly about being Jewish, people talking openly about the occupation, which is horrendous, which is atrocious, which has to be ended very soon. And at the age of almost 75, I have been regenerated. I feel much younger and with much more hope. Thank you so much.
I don't know what to say after that, really. I have three questions. I'm just going to make them as short as possible. They're very different. One is, I'd like to know if there's a difference between the way women live the occupation in the Palestinian quarters compared to men. Second would be, I know that the Jewish people and the Palestinians have a lot to work on, and it's a long healing and dialogue process. But throughout history, there's so many other peoples that have so many genocides, so many things have gone, the Rwanda, East Timor, Russia, I mean, so many cultures and countries are living what you people are living. Have you ever been in a situation where you've heard people from these different cultures working on this and sharing with one another what you're going through, and like the process that one is going through and working through it and going beyond and opening up to dialogue and openness? This is a second thing. And today I was also listening to something on the radio, because CKUT has a lot of things concerning Palestinians and dialogue and everything. And they were saying that in the NAC, the National African Congress, had a great organization to struggle against apartheid, which is what is being lived with you people. Is there anything that you need some kind of a vehicle, maybe the Alliance is working in that sense, joining with other groups to form a strong body to be able to combat these walls, to break them down, psychological walls first of all, and then crystallizing in the actual wall. Is there any kind of move? Do you feel that there's this coming together to create a parallel organization that's more than just Quebec, Canada, but that's going to maybe get to that point where the NAC was able to break down it's not broken down completely in South Africa, but I'm just saying there is some kind of work that they were working on that has to be done, obviously, but in many coming together.
Okay. The women.
Women?
That's what she wanted. Well, that's in the order in which they were asked.
Well, can I not use that order? No. Okay. Okay, I will talk about your last point and be very brief about it because I realize it's late. And that is simply that there are more and more groups, Jewish groups, all over the world that are entering into a very large network. And there, whether it's in the States, whether it's in Europe, all over Europe, in Canada, in South America, and those groups are very active everywhere in their own particular area. And I think that for instance, you can just look at the internet, in terms of the Jewish groups involved in these issues. And I think just to end on that is that one of the important work of all of these groups when you talk about breaking down is that we must encourage Jewish people to go there, to go to Israel with their eyes open, if they can, but to go to Palestine. They're going to have a difficult time getting into Palestine, but to go, whether it's with ISM, whether it's another group, and I think this is the message coming across all over the world, and it's an important message, because more people will go, the more people go, the less you can hide behind it. Do you want to do women in...
No, that's your thing.
Okay, women in...
I do know that women are experiencing the occupation and the intifada very differently from men and from the previous intifada, yeah. Because as there is a polarization, a further polarization, as it becomes increasingly difficult to have a large nonviolent demonstration, women get marginalized, except for those very few already on the margins who will become suicide bombers. It's also, of course, had a tremendous effect on the Palestinian economy, or the economy in Palestinian territories, which means that women's jobs have been threatened. Women, are in a place where there is economic desperation. Women are in the worst conditions. This comes as no surprise, but the specific effects on women in the Palestinian labor force have been just amazing and devastating. So in that sense, yes. Shira, can I tell about your mother? The only thing I know about your mother. Shira, you told me that your mother said when you got involved in this work, and particularly when you said you were going with the ISM, she said, "But I thought you were a feminist." Could you tell us how you responded to that?
Well, I went to the West Bank. How did I respond to that?
Well, she saw a contradiction between being a feminist and supporting Palestinian rights.
Right. Well, I mean, I don't think I responded to it very well because it was my mother, and, you know, things are complicated. But I mean, the way I would respond to it were to have that opportunity again.
Yes. A year and a half of hindsight she's got, too.
Exactly.
Just go.
Are that, I mean, that it's you can't separate somebody from their... A woman is a human being, and a woman is a Palestinian, and if a woman is under occupation, she's under occupation as much as a man. You can't say that, you know, you can't talk about someone being liberated by gender if you're not talking about someone being liberated in general. I'm not answering this particularly well. All that hindsight, and it didn't do much. But I think that there is this use of what is truly a patriarchal culture, but there's this use of that fact as a way of demonizing and misunderstanding things that are going on in occupied Palestine and in the Arab world in general. Yeah, absolutely.
No, I understood. I think it's also important, it's one of those taboos in the Jewish community and in Israeli society, and that is to know that Palestinian women are raped. Palestinian women do undergo those type of hardships that all women under occupation, under war conditions, they undergo. It is a very difficult topic. We don't like to think that our boys will do that. They do, and they do many other things.
Well, first of all, yeah, that's exactly true, what Fabiana is saying, and that would have been the right answer. Another thing, though, is that in regards to your question about Palestinian women, although I don't feel that I can in any way speak for Palestinian women or, you know, have any sense of the sort of breadth of their experience, one thing that somebody did say to me was that in the First Intifada, a woman could resist by, you know, if a soldier wanted to take your child from you and throw him in a prison, you could sort of put him behind you and protect him that way. And in the Second Intifada, the soldier would just shoot you if you did that. And I think that that heightened level of violence has, as was said, really eliminated the possibility of sort of that regular day-to-day nonviolent resistance, which women really do engage in. Although I still think Palestinian women are involved in resistance, and I think they do that by maintaining families, by maintaining close ties within communities, by maintaining homes where there is nothing, and finding food where there is none, and just making, you know, making life continue when it seems almost impossible.
There was one more question in the middle about massive, multiple genocides in the world.
The sharing.
Yeah, right. Well, yes and no.
No, I'm saying how you live, because maybe you've never been in a circumstance where with other people were living the same thing, so I don't know, maybe.
We all live among First Nations people.
Yeah.
Wherever else we've been in the world. We know we are living on native land. I have a First Nations colleague who says, you know, to Palestinians, we've been under occupation for 300 years. One of the problems is that on the one hand, sometimes the word genocide is used very loosely by movements for human rights, and on the other hand, that some Jews think we've got a monopoly on it, that the Holocaust means not only that it exonerates us from whatever else we do henceforth, but that that atrocity was so great that nothing else can measure up to it, and you call anything else genocide and it's insulting, and so on. It's a complicated problem. There is very little sharing across these ethnic lines. and certainly the acceptance of the genocide on which the two major, well, three major North American countries was based is never part of the discourse. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I'd like to make us cognizant about this word anti-Semite, which I think, just like we're talking about, the way words are used, like Holocaust and things like that, words are a tool of politics. They don't mean anything. It depends who's using it how. I was invited once to a conference in Germany on Das Eigene und das Fremde. This means yourself and the other. And it was amazing. Everybody had their selves and their others. And there really was no coming together. I was shocked coming, I was from the United States at that time, as a good American, thinking, well, we're going to work this out. It was all, everybody was myself and the other. This whole thing about anti-Semitism is also a game of words, because it depends who's using it against who. You know, an Orthodox Jew might call you an anti-Semite. Whoever, or whoever. It's all just a game of words, because in fact, not unless I'm wrong, please correct me, the Jews and the Palestinians are both Semites. Therefore, who is anti-Semitic to who? Actually, they're brothers and sisters.
Cousins.
Well,
yeah.
Brothers
at least they're cousins.
It could
really?
Be.
No, I mean, I feel that
sisters.
Very strongly when I see Palestinian students at Concordia with the the keffiyeh has slipped and it looks like a, you know, a talis, a Jewish prayer shawl, and the, you know, the thin shoulders, and I say, my God, it's a yeshiva book, you know, but I, and the nose, you know, the you know, I mean, the, there is a sense in which we, you know, we are cousins, and another sense in which the people who first came up with the term anti-Semite and claimed it for themselves, wanted to be anti-Semites, were Jew haters. They were not thinking about the other peoples in the Middle East. And so historically, that's where it
right,
comes
so
from.
Yeah, yeah, is that
yeah.
When people might call you anti-Semitic or something because you're against the atrocities that the Israelis are doing, this is a game of politics. And we have to be careful not to give them that power, because it really is just how you twist the words. You know, to Stalin, he had a democracy. That was bullshit, right? Yeah, so, and George Bush, I won't even say what that is. So that this is all, we have to be careful about words and then how we can be manipulated and put us on the defensive when the argument has nothing to do with that.
Mm-hmm.
It has to do with how some human beings are treating other human beings.
Very true. I think for one thing for me is that I put anti-Semitism in its place. It's racism. It's anti-Jewish racism.
Mm-hmm.
For me, that's
yeah.
it.
But, you know, the thing is that for some people, the other racisms don't matter. The talking about words, the right wing has appropriated a certain number of what could be, you know, moving and beautiful terms for themselves, for their own meanings, like the right to life means the right to prevent a woman from controlling her body.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
mm-hmm.
Exactly. And one of those is the phrase never again. Because to some of us, never again means never again must racism be allowed to metamorphose into genocide against anybody. But for many people, it means never again to us.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not a way for Jews to be safe. But that's again the way the way the concepts underlying language are manipulated.
Well, Orwell wrote a wonderful essay in 1946
mm-hmm.
called The English Language and Politics.
Politics.
And we have to keep that always in our forethinking.
Just a quick response. I think one misuse of the term anti-Semitism and one way that it becomes manipulated is that anti-Semitism speaks to a particular form of racism, which was European, which was located in Europe, and was located the Jew as the sort of perennial other, and
you know, for centuries, and that's true. I mean, that was something that's very real. But something that it's been used to describe is hatred of Jews or racism towards Jews anywhere, ever, you know, now, the past, so we start talking about anti-Semitism in Arab countries and in Palestine as though it's the same thing, as though it's the same process, which not only is totally falsifies the reality of Jewish experience in Arab countries, which was considerably better by and large than in Europe, but it also diminishes the reality of that kind of anti-Semitism, which I think we do need to explore and understand.
Okay, it looks like it's time to wrap up. And thank you all for coming. Do we have the hat back?